Brought to you by the fine makers of X-Lax, music for the mind.
On Saturday.
Yeah.
I found out yesterday, and then a friend called me today. I wasn't sure what time the service was.
I don't know. Have you got a promo? Is it going to come from?
I don't know. What should we do here? We're on now. What do we do?
Explain death.
Why?
We're going to talk to dead people who are going to tell us how lovely it is. It's beyond any concept you could ever imagine up to this point.
Would you look at this? Somebody's been putting my initials down here.
Huh. Kent, why?
Yeah.
You're a
See that? Kent, why?
Yeah, why? Why are you leaving?
Why am I leaving?
Why am I leaving? Yeah, bring your own beer. BYOB.
No,
KYOB.
Yes.
Their phones are ringing, folks. Everybody, they can't.
This is.
They
we got Ray on here, so we're going
to. Oh, Ray? Well, yes. Ray's going to have to listen. He's always wanted to be dead. This is going to tell him how.
No,
to
we're
going to
try and get Ray on over here. And
you want to get Ray on?
Oh, yeah.
Right now?
Yeah.
We'll have Ray on and intro the death state.
Oh, hopefully, we're going to have Ray in.
Come on in, Ray. Does she know how to do it?
Yes.
Okay.
She does know how to do this. Bob, she is technically adept.
Oh, I know.
As opposed to.
I know nothing about singing, Kent. I know nothing about singing, and I remain steadfast about that.
Mike's on the phone over there, so we're going to have to wait just a minute here.
You hear us?
Well, let me talk about what we're going to hear.
Okay, what are we going to hear, Bob?
In September, maybe the 28th, this past fall, I had the...
Check this out here. PGR. Look at the
program for... And Bob. What's that?
And Bob.
I don't know what that is.
So this anyways, one's in bombs.
In September.
Bob's in bombs.
Bob bombs. So in
in
September, I was talking to the exes, and I started off asking about the difference between LSD and mescaline. Because it had come up in a previous session I had with them. And so they started talking about that, and then it led into the question of people having psychic experiences, or thought they did, under LSD. And that led into life in the psychic realm, or life in the post-death realm. And then they updated, for all of humanity, what happens when you're dead. And it's incredible. You're going to be so happy when you hear this. You know, really, it's going to... But we do not want you to try it at home, right? Okay. Yeah, but how do you disclaim that?
Remember that? Do not try this at home. This is a dangerous stunt.
Do not take death into your own hands.
Yes.
Let us deal with that.
Yes.
Let us impose the death at the proper time, ecologically.
So let's just feed this back so much that the disclaimer is just not going to be heard. Remember again, this is ear candy.
Yeah. And this is not meant to be anything significant.
Yes,
just
this
your
is ear
life.
Candy.
Welcome to your life.
Yes.
And the big question is, after you hear this, is there life before death, right? Rather than after death. So the question is, we ponder that for an hour as we contemplate the fact
that... What the hell are you looking for?
That Kent will not be here after tonight. And that's very sad. That means we'll have to have new program notes, and we'll never see the phrase Club 22 again and CKLM's program notes.
Oh, so, we don't know about that.
We got a whole bunch of Zappa talk tonight. Frank is threatening to move to Australia. We'll hear him talk about that. He also explains such esoteric motifs like Grand Wazoo and Evelyn the dog, the modified dog. Incredible stuff. We got all night long. This is going to be
such a bitchin' show.
Kent's best show, and it's just ear candy.
It's ear candy.
It's
mental floss.
It's Afro-Canadian month. Kent's version.
Mental floss. Mental floss. Hey, Bob, watch out for the chair.
Bob's ready. Bob's getting into position.
Hanging around here.
Tom's on 7-9.
Uh-oh.
There's a pragmatic event here.
Tom,
oh, yes.
Pick it up?
Yes. Yeah. I know what
Tom
is talking about. No, he's not on the air.
He can theoretically be on the air. You talk to him.
Well, take the speaker. Okay. We can hear him.
No, we can't.
Hey,
Tom. You're on the air, Tom. Almost.
Billy.
Okay, go ahead. What's the problem? No, I'm not on the air.
Darn. Yeah. Can't get him? Oh, yeah, Mike's on the other line.
Mike's on the other line, Kent.
We'll just turn that out there.
Okay.
We've
got to take it through the other studio if
yes.
you want it.
Yeah.
So we're still waiting for Ray.
Yes, we're waiting for Ray, and we're going to wait for Mike.
Right.
What should we do?
Well,
should we play, like, a whole basic poop load of promos?
Is it time for that?
Yeah.
Lined up here?
I don't know. Don't care. So can't use that one because that's... There. Well, we'll go with this one. Is there anything going over the air? Obviously, there isn't.
Yeah.
We'll wait for a cart to re-queue.
Hey, Kent, what are we doing? Ready?
We have to wait for Ray.
Freedom in a Vacuum at the Music Gallery marches into your life each Thursday in March, featuring some of the most vital and exciting experimental music from around the world.
The series begins with
the dreamlike sonic
images,
PGR. Hailing from San Francisco, PGR debuts its ambient chaos in Toronto on March 7th at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West. The concert begins at 8 o'clock p.m. with Kazunichi setting a mysterious mood for Twin Peaks sound editor PGR. Tickets are $9, $7 for students at the door. Call Laura at 53 Music for more clues.
Are we on?
Brought to you by the Music Gallery, CKLM, and Ball.
Oh, we're out of promo, I say. put that down there. There.
Freedom in a Vacuum, the concert series, continues on March 14th when If Juana and David Prescott join the American invasion by storming the Music Gallery, located at 1087 Queen Street West. These two veteran musicians from New York and Boston join forces to launch a sonic attack on your ears, mind, and heart. Launching the primary mission at 2000 hours EST is the Canadian force of Chris Devonshire. The only winner in this war is you. Tickets are $9, $7 for students at the door. More official information can be obtained at 53 Music, an allied presentation of the Music Gallery and CKLN-FM. Not available on CNN.
Listen, all you people way up there, all the black people everywhere.
China and Japan, even Japan and Iran, Afghanistan. Let's get down to downtown, really down out of town.
The situation is like history. Listen to my philosophy. Let's get busy. 1, 2, 3, get funky.
With Black History Month, we're going to celebrate. It's time to congregate.
If you don't cooperate, your brains are going to be incinerated. Unity, unity. Everybody likes unity. We're talking about our community, not about people in slavery.
George Bush says he wants unity. Barone says he wants unity.
Has given the subgeniuses hours and hours of slack, more than the show itself.
He's so darn kind.
Bob, are you there?
You gotta come over here, Bob.
So, I was just hoping that the electric babies of Bob's show would come and visit Kent now and seduce him into not leaving, because he's so important to us.
That's right, Ray. It's a tragedy what's happening. That's why we're playing the death tape tonight.
Absolutely. I was going to say to that caller who was thinking about the island and what it is, if Toronto is Babylon, then perhaps the islands are Avalon.
Yes, that's right. But that's an old nostalgic image. You're lucky, Ray, that there's nothing old under the sun, so we'll accept that.
Thank you.
Avalon is what it is.
Well,
you made a movie on that island.
That's right, and I had to bridge that into this evening, because we're going to be discussing mescaline and LSD, and peyote had a big role. That's the organic form of mescaline. Had a big role in our Crystal in the Tower. So.
You'll enjoy this, Ray.
Pardon me?
You'll enjoy what you're going to hear.
I'm sure. I'm dead already. In fact, I'm in mourning.
Well, maybe we'll talk to you after the broadcast, see what you say. You probably will get the most honest, immediate response and celebration of it. So, Ray, look.
Thanks again, Kent, for all the slack that you've given us. It's been great.
It has been wonderful, and I guess it's very appropriate to have you on, Ray, to say that.
The Nighthawks and the Night Owls, thank you, Kent.
All right, Kent's in the other room, but he certainly was...
Here now.
Oh, yeah, he's thanking you. The Nighthawks and the Night Owls.
And Electric Babies, it's your last chance. Come to Kent.
Yeah. He says, Electric Babies, it's your last chance to come to Kent. Okay, Ray, thanks a lot. There are some people who are taping this, so we better get into it. They're tired.
All right.
Okay, Ray?
Yeah.
We'll talk to you.
Be feeling you, Bob.
I'll talk to you in an hour or so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good night.
Later.
The Fathers of Calgary and the Calgary Stampede, and so many others from our community that played a major role in the development of this world. Thank you.
My name is Charlie Roach. I'm a lawyer. My law is focused on human rights and on civil liberties. These days, I'm very concerned about the effects of the war on people of African heritage. I think it will have a tremendous impact on people of African heritage. There are going to be many refugees in the Sudan. There are going to be quite a lot of problems with Black Americans, in particular, and alienation to their society. I see the war as a racist war. And I see it also as one in which we have General Colin Powell, who is going to be sort of a role model for young blacks, and I don't think that that's a positive, good role model. I prefer the Martin Luther King, and I believe in reaching out with a great deal of love and understanding to my fellow men.
Mike on Sunday.
Oh, hey! This is death, boys and girls.
I was interested if you could explain what LSD does to our bodies and the experience that happens to people under, you know, very good quality LSD.
LSD itself does affect the sensorium. However, it crosses certain mental barriers, especially those barriers associated with the other than the sensorium, in that it affects the portions of the brain associated with seeing, associated with the touch, etc. Now, these are the perceptive organs, perceptive portions of the brain. It affects those. The sensorium itself is little touched, but the amount of information that is then feeding back from these organs that sense, of course, realize they must have a pattern within themselves in order to sense. And the patterns begin to go back into the sensorium. It's different than mescaline, because mescaline work on the sensorium itself. The sensorium have a tendency to draw upon the organs of sensation, while LSD have a tendency to push from the senses into the sensorium.
Would that mean sort of like the nerves of sensing of the sensory organs then are affected rather than the sensorium?
Yes.
And where is the sensorium in the skull, you know, inside?
The reticular formation.
Where is that? Do you know that?
Right in the absolute center, the most protected portion of the brain itself.
Now, what about the hypothalamus and the thalamus? Or is that...
that is part of that.
So that's the most intimate part of the human brain.
Exactly.
Particular.
Yes.
And is that connected to the animal part? What's the part that we have the base of the brain?
There are three brains.
Yeah, let's just review that.
Mm. Well, there is that which is termed the primal brain. And that is a very low senses of itself. Then the next up is what we described as the recognition brain, associated with simian learning. And then there is the forebrain, the cortex, full cortex of the brain, the upper brain. Now, connecting all of this is the reticular formation itself.
And that includes the hypothalamus?
Yes.
All
within that grouping. Now, the point is, take mescaline, and the sensorium itself changes subtly so that it can draw upon the sense perception organs of the brain. It draws upon them. The taking of LSD, because it does affect at the level of the nerves, causes firing of these senses, which are then perceived by the sensorium. So, it could be seen that one is creative and one is imposed.
Which one's creative?
Mescaline.
And one's imposed on the sensorium?
Well, that's LSD.
Yeah, you impose on the sensorium, is what you meant there.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, does the sensorium, this deepest part of the brain, the most, what do we call it, the most precious part?
Term it that,
yeah.
Yes.
Did the apes have that part? Or is that a human part?
All primates have that.
All right. Does it connect to psychic experiences and other dimensions? Is that a core part that relates to that?
Mm. So it itself can, yes.
All right, now, Tim Leary, in discussing and writing about LSD, he put much spiritual emphasis on it, and he made a book paralleling the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is, you know, a religious manifesto and tradition from Tibet in that area, that describes the process that the soul goes through when they die, when one dies. Leary made a parallel with the experiences on LSD and claims you go through these death experiences on LSD, though you don't die. Is his parallel accurate, or is he exaggerating the, shall we call, the spiritual part of LSD? Is he exaggerating the spiritual meaning of LSD?
Well, he's exaggerating it because, realize that if you would describe LSD as an inward experience, that would be a good description. Because realizing all of the data that is stored in a particular portion of the brain, let's just choose one, the eyes. The eyes connect to a certain portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing. Now, in that portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing, there is a pattern recognition program. LSD trigger that and force the sensorium of the brain to perceive that which it is firing to the sensorium.
Right.
But only pattern recognition. But it is so, I term it, not coherent.
So what?
It's not so coherent. It's incoherent.
Yeah.
And because it is incoherent, the sensorium tries to make sense of it. tries to make a rational of it.
And this is perceived by the user as a very tense drama, right? The making sense of it.
Yes. Look at a person on LSD. Shine a bright light at them. The eyes perceive it. The portion of the brain that is responsible for seeing perceives it. But what message does it send to the sensorium? Of random. Incoherent.
Yeah.
The sensorium tries to make sense of it. And says that it is being inundated by white rays, that it is whatever, 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 depending upon the state of mind of the individual taking it.
Yeah.
LSD is also location dependent. LSD given in a clinical situation will produce one result. Taken in a group meeting where there is guitars and singing in a different environment. But of all of these, mescaline is different. Mescaline will be relatively consistent no matter what situation is taken.
Okay, what is the drama that goes on, the internal voice that's talking and either getting exhilarated by the, you can help me on this if you want, getting exhilarated by the sensory confusion or getting panicky, is that a physiological part of ego? It's not a soul thing.
No.
That really makes out, because he says, you know, you're killing your ego and it's a spiritual thing. That's exaggerating just the effect of sensory confusion?
Exactly.
And I think you're implying mescaline is the most spiritual, if you want to put that kind of implication on matter.
Well, yes. Now, the other side of this is that LSD confuses the sensory organs so that the pattern is disturbed. Realize how long it took you to learn to see. It took you time to learn to see. You had to form the pattern.
Yeah.
And to learn to see. Now, that pattern established in yourself is then set awry by LSD, forming a new pattern. So therefore, when a person have, quote, flashbacks, unquote, they're just accessing that pattern that has been disturbed and is now a new pattern.
So the LSD does not affect the sensorium, the thalamus, and the hypothalamus, as someone once told me it does.
Mm.
It affects it indirectly.
Indirectly it's affected,
yeah.
Yes.
And certainly not on a spiritual or positive way.
No.
So, all right. Now, just to go along another direction, is the Tibetan Book of the Dead an accurate description of the process of physical death and what happens when you go into the other dimensions?
It's accurate to its own belief system.
Yeah.
Realizing that every society has its approach to death. So if you would take the Egyptian Book of the Dead, with the emphasis on Osiris and Styx, you see, one must cross that river. Culturally, that entire society was river-oriented.
Yeah.
They lived by the river. They died by the river. It killed them, and it fed them. It was central to their existence and central to their continuance. If you look into the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it will then cause another view of the society. Each society dies to its own belief conventions.
So that would mean, Evergreen, that what people experience after death then would be somewhat or completely a result of their belief system.
Exactly.
That they had before they died.
Yes.
And so it's, none of it's really true.
Well, oh, it's very true. To the person who was doing this. Well, exactly. Well, that is comfort. Death is fear. So you must overlay death with a belief system of what happened at death.
Is that why people go to sleep after they die for a while sometimes?
Oftentimes.
And they have to go through that dream?
Because they have such a belief system that if they did not, then total confusion, total loss of self.
Well, does one meet their relatives and loved ones, so to speak, when you die, or is that all in this imaginary dream state?
No, it's not in the imaginary dream state, but when there is a dream state created, oftentimes, in the dream state, those relatives, friends, associates, etc., will enter the dream to pull the person out of the dream.
Mm. So there's a death experience beyond this belief system.
Exactly.
Which is what you know.
Yes.
When you say you know, what's that?
Evergreen.
You mean, is there a surveillance of humans as they die by this other dimension? We call it the astral plane, is that acceptable?
Term it whatever you want.
The astral plane. Are they surveilling and helping people through, and they have to kind of monitor people's consciousnesses when they come through?
Not so much monitor, but allow the person to live his belief system so that they can enter the belief system and alter it. Now, consider the number of ways that we have cast off clay. The number of societies that we have belonged to. And we've belonged to a considerable number of societies. From hunter societies to simple farming to advanced societies. Now, each one of these had a different Book of the Dead. Now, a near-death experience to a person in a hunting community will be associated with, quote, the happy hunting grounds. You see?
And that imagery manifests to them in their dream state.
Because that is what is necessary for them. Now, take a Christian near-death experience.
All right, just do that thing, right. People who take LSD, they have the flashback. Because they might believe what Leary said and relate it to psychological problems or spiritual metaphors, they have to realize they've been changed by LSD. You know, beyond chromosome damage, you have changed yourself. And the recall of that should be taken as a factor of remembering the experience. Therefore, there doesn't need to be that much confusion or worry about flashback.
Mm.
The flashback is proof that you've changed.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about it as a damage.
Exactly. But at the same time, LSD without Leary's book is not useful. Because you could use Leary's book or you could use a telephone book, in truth. But if you predict the predicted, then you will live the prediction, which is not the same as a mescaline experience.
You can't do that with mescaline. You can't predict what's going to happen to each individual person.
Or even to the same person. You see, that is the difference between the two substances. Mescaline would give you, the first time you take it, you would have that experience. The objective is not to relive the experience, but use the change to find out other parameters of yourself. So take mescaline as a platform, a stepping stone, to find that other transparency is the objective. LSD returns you to where you were all the time. The only difference is the neuron firings.
Right, so one would maybe take mescaline in 2 years again after you have properly absorbed it and changed, and then you'd arrive at a new platform, maybe take the mescaline to leap to another level.
That was the ultimate use of it. And because of that, that's why it's been, mescaline has been placed in a religious connotation.
It's
not a recreation drug.
Yeah.
It's there that one would, by the taking it, go to first year university, then later go to second year university, but never to return where one was. Ever. Not the reason for it.
Yeah, see, the Evergreens define second coming as a time of, the religious concept of second coming as a time of perpetual change. The advantage of electric conditions, the service of our society, if you can handle it, is that you don't get stuck in tribal rituals and group patterns that man did in the kind of totalitarian life they had in each little tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Our society is so fractionalized and individual autonomy is possible under the electric technological environment. If we can change and go to higher levels or of experience, I don't know if it's higher, but new levels of experience faster and not be limited by replays.
Exactly. And that is why, where you have a fractionalization of societies, realize that those societies were artificially congregated, artificially cemented together. Because... it was the belief that larger, better, etc., etc. And it goes through the cycle where it form, break apart, reform. Now, where there are very large tribes, the fractionalization divides tribe into sub-tribe, into sub-tribe, into individual. There is only one tribe, and that's individual. As McLuhan says, eventually it will be one person interacting with one person, interacting with one person, interacting with one person. Consider a person 200 years ago. Who are you, is the question asked. That person will say, he is English, a Londoner, an East Ender, you see, graphically located, geographically secure, and that is his identity. Location is identity. But with fractionalization and the force of fractionalization means that location geographically is not important anymore, but the location of consciousness is. So as geographics decrease, consciousness increases. Who are you? The question we ask you. You would say that you are a North American. Canadian. Torontonian. But not specifically bound by that. Because where were you before? East Coast Canada. You see?
If you ask me who I was now, I would use a lot of McLuhan's ideas. I say I'm discarnate. I'm everybody on the planet. I'm so intimately connected now.
So that discarnate in truth, a word that can be confused with something else, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But if you would say discountried, yes. Disgeographicized, yes.
Yeah, because actually, McClellan's term discount implies going beyond our bodies, beyond our senses. What he meant by that, internal sensory life. But we are enhancing our sensory life, basically. But there's a distinction between sensory life and internal sensory life. Well, is that, that well? That's a paradox. It's not a necessary distinction, right?
Yes.
All right.
It is to a certain level of consciousness. It's necessary to distinguish between internal, external. What is being realized is that internal is affected by external, external is affected by internal, and there's a symbiosis between the two that causes continual elevation.
Right, and the electric environment has extended our tactile sensorium, which is very inner.
Yes.
So we're living in an inner environment. So.
Yes. Now, consider the concept of Waldo. Waldo is a simulacrum of a human that can work in other environments than a human.
Is this a computer? I don't know what Waldo is.
It's a person operating a tractor at a distance.
Oh.
He sits on the edge of the field and with his duplicate set of controls, controls the tractor going up and down the field.
Yes.
Hmm? Now, with sufficient feedback, there is no distinguishing between being in that tractor or on the side.
What would be the not discarnate? What would be, you would say that is? Dis what? Dislocalized.
Dislocalized.
Yeah.
Now, let us suggest that you have a simulacrum of yourself that's 2 inches tall. It does everything that you command it to do.
Yeah.
It go up a pipe, it tighten a bolt, it adjust a valve.
It looks like me.
It could look like anything.
Yeah.
But as far as you're concerned, you're 2 inches tall. Going through small openings.
Yeah.
Into et cetera, et cetera.
In terms of what I can accomplish.
In terms of what you can accomplish. But the point we're stressing is that is a certain ultimate of a certain electric age.
Less than 100 years or so?
No, that's not less than 50.
Less than 50?
Yes. Now, consider for a moment that a telephone puts yourself wherever you choose to be.
Yeah. What's wrong with the term discarnate?
It has been used to describe spirits.
Right.
Rather than loss of localization.
Which, if you explain that way, it's a useful term.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's why Marshall meant it.
Yes.
Yeah. Can I... Do you want to say something more about this?
No.
Okay.
Elapsed time, please.
Well, about 56 minutes.
All right.
It get more shared across the next several years as the world go through this area of tension, and then as that abate, then more sharing after that.
The way you spell out, the Russians are leading in this.
Yes.
They've got the edge. They've invented something, discovered something that other people don't have. The way you say the phrase "area of tension," I've been thinking about that the past week. We are. Someone told me the other day that George Bush has been planning and preparing for the scenario we have in the Middle East now for years for a potential war. Is this that archetypal Armageddon scenario that's concentrated in the Middle East? We're going to go through that, and that's what you mean by area of tension. We've got this backlog to go through there, right?
Yes, much has to be solved.
Beg your pardon?
Much has to be solved. much.
Much of the implied racism between the different oligarchs.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's, we've come to that head, so, I mean, I'm optimistic. I think the Evergreens are optimistic. But we have come this fall to the Armageddon scenario that people have been looking for.
But this, we assure you, is not Armageddon.
Right, it's not going to happen.
No. This is not the final, final. But at the same time, much solved by it. Much solved by it. Realize, for the first time in the history of man, there's been a concerted effort against an aggressor. Well, that aggressor has no allies.
That's no. New.
That's very new. First time in recorded history.
Now, the final Armageddon, what is the date of that, or the potential of that?
The final Armageddon? Very, very different. Very different. When there are no aggressors, consciousness changes. It's not peace that people want, because peace is not an absence of war. To go beyond peace, not to go beyond war, but to go beyond peace is the answer.
But
and this must end soon.
Well, the final Armageddon is 2,000 years from now?
The greatest Armageddon of all is when you realize that almost all of the knowledge that you've gained can be shifted by the introduction of new knowledge. That's Armageddon. Not of war, but a vast, vast leap in knowledge. And that happened within the next 500.
And that's what McLuhan implied.
Yes.
Yeah. That resonates.
And now this must end.
Okay. Is there any final comment?
Best end.
Thank you. Dear Lord, please enfold these entities in thy love and thy perfection. Amen. Please clear any negative influences from these entities now.
Damn.
Allow the body to become completely relaxed. Perform any healing which may need to be performed. Begin increasing the blood pressure to normal naturally. And begin returning all other systems of the body to normal naturally now.
Damn.
And thank you for our sessions and fairly well.
Well, we do thank you. To you both. God's blessing.
Thank you. And now I would like Michael to awaken, feeling completely refreshed, relaxed, and loved. Now.
Came out of that session seeing a person who was from the 1200s in this environment today. Now, it's not that he would be imposing his superstitions on top of this. And it's not that it wouldn't take him long to get used to it, but the stresses created by it would be enormous. Just enormous. Patterns of his life would be changed by the very fact that you don't go to bed when it gets dark. And you don't have to light rushes, and therefore you don't have to spend time making rushes.
So what's he going to do?
So the light goes on, and he's waiting for nightfall, you know. Looks out the window, sees it is nightfall. Looks inside the room, it's brilliantly lit. In fact, more brilliantly lit than if it was sunshine.
That's like being on LSD.
Yeah.
Confusion of signals.
total confusion. Couldn't understand, would understand a television set, but have to teach himself to see it.
Yeah.
It would be moving too fast for him. Everything would be moving too fast. We speak too fast. We think too fast. We think too fast.
Yeah.
In other words, what's 6 times 6? 36. He would say, the 1200s man would say 6 times 6 is 36. You know,
yeah.
That pause in there,
yeah,
is, doesn't sound like much, but it's indicative of almost everything else. Take him time to think. And I, like you say to him, 5 minutes before lunch, what would you like for lunch? And he didn't really have to think about it.
Yeah.
Well, he knows what he's like, but he doesn't
it's, you know, having a restaurant is an incredible experience.
Yeah.
I mean, other people prepare food for you. Yes.
Now, does this person get used to it? Or does
yes.
life is stressing, has a heart attack and dies, you know?
Well, he gets used to it, but he's not in sync with it, if you know what I mean.
You never get in sync.
Never get in sync with it, really. He just goes along and copies the pattern. But there's
where
amazed
he'd other people from.
Yeah,
he'd be isolated.
Mm, he'd be isolated.
Yeah.
But he'd be amazed by the amount of genius in this world.
He would be.
Yeah, just yeah. amazed by it.
Well, he'd think they were the gods had landed. That,
yeah, everybody's a god.
Yeah.
Everybody's a god.
And then that would be very alienating to him.
Yeah, very,
he'd
very
feel
hard.
Isolated?
Yeah.
He's in the wrong place.
Oh, yeah.
He's not equipped to be a god.
No, he's not equipped to be a god. Consciousness equips a person to be God.
Now, McLuhan, in one of his early books, consciousness equips a person to be God. What is consciousness?
I wanted to get into that. I backed off because
we were talking about as much as the language could say it.
They said one phrase, and I just went, wait a minute.
What was that?
What was that?
You want me to tell you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah,
they said that consciousness is not me. That's the people, there are those who believe that, but it's not true. Now, see, I don't think consciousness is me, but I do say consciousness cannot flourish in a human being if the identity is not developed.
Okay.
The me is not developed, so it's dependent on a me.
Okay.
The me is sort of consciousness in a way.
Well, it's only a fraction of consciousness. It's only a fraction of consciousness. It's a vital point. Agreed.
Right.
Agreed.
I think that, well, in our dialogue with the Evergreens, we say something, and just like they said, it's me. They would say, we're way off on that, but it's the nature of language to emphasize this point at this moment, and it's true. But so they would agree with you.
Yeah,
I think so.
You know, even though if you pick up on
that
one point,
it's
so
mercurial.
You've
got to
have
it.
Yeah. You've got
it. It's true
enough
to the same
Yeah.
But when I get down to it is identity is an element of consciousness. But one thing is that consciousness continually reinforces identity. Continually.
To be free.
So here we have my identity as a person in 1200s is limited by the nature that I live in. We have, to an extent, overcome nature.
Yeah.
Our cycles have changed, etc. I can pick up the phone. I'm in contact with Vancouver in seconds.
Yeah. Faster than you can contact your neighbor here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If we had a race between Ellie and I and the telephone and the next door neighbor, she'd win.
Yeah.
So our consciousness is literally changing. Now, are we any smarter? Yes. We're a hell of a lot smarter because of that.
But we had the paradox of existence is that you have new problems with your new smartness.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's what they were talking about, the complexity of when you're looking at your lives
right.
and when you're dead, you keep creating a new complexity. So
yeah.
the dialectic's always there. The tension is always there, we'll call it. You know what I mean?
The learning tension. The tension of needing to learn.
Yeah.
Or of thinking, am I covered? Am I going to get hurt? We should ask about pain or something there.
Well, anyway, came out of that session with one thing that was very, very important, and that's for the time in which a person lives, they're very smart. Very smart.
Yeah, humans have always been smart.
Have always been smart to the parameters of the situation that they are in.
Right.
Yeah, there's a part of us that doesn't change. It's the attentiveness of consciousness is always the same.
Yeah, the attentiveness is always the same.
Yeah.
It's the means by which consciousness uses itself that it expands. It's almost like consciousness is like any muscle. It gets stronger if you exercise it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the muscle's changing because you change your muscles.
You change your muscles.
You're mutating your body, then you exercise it differently.
Exactly.
By using TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As an example.
What was interesting came out of that. I was watching a little kid who was watching television. This little kid was watching television, thoroughly engrossed in it. It was a Sesame Street something.
Yeah.
The kid was thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying it. As he was watching, the neurons in his brain were forming, strengthening, and etc.
Well, you could see
them. I could see that. I could see all the neurons in
you
the brain.
You know it. Well, you weren't seeing lights flashing, but you were knowing that.
And the other one was seeing two hemispheres of the brain and the connecting corpus callosum.
Yeah.
Seeing that. Now, this is going to be a real contentious because, oh my God, this can be read two ways, and I don't want it to be.
By us?
By everybody.
Okay.
But as consciousness increases, so does the corpus callosum.
Mm-hmm.
The brain's going to change.
Yeah, the brain is changing. Physically, the brain is changing.
The corpus callosum, the connector between the two halves.
It becomes thicker and thicker and thicker.
Because it's more, getting more stuff.
More communication.
Well, are skulls going to get bigger or something?
No.
Well, the corpus callosum, the thing that connects the two halves. If it gets bigger, that just means there's more interchange between the two halves.
Yeah, it's going to be a stronger internal muscle.
So
within
internal
its
muscle. Yeah.
Within its primers of our normal skull.
Yeah. And that's it.
Ow, sorry.
Vacuum at the Music Gallery marches into your life each Thursday in March, featuring some of the most vital and exciting experimental music from around the world. The series begins with the dreamlike sonic images of PGR. Hailing from San Francisco, PGR debuts its Ambient Chaos in Toronto on March 7th at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West. The concert begins at 8 o'clock p.m. with Kazunichi setting a mysterious mood for Twin Peaks sound editor PGR. Tickets are $9, $7 for students at the door. Call Laura at 53 Music for more clues. Brought to you by the Music Gallery, CKLN, and Ball. The concert series continues on March 14th when Ifguana and David Prescott join the American invasion by storming the Music Gallery located at 1087 Queen Street West. These two veteran musicians from New York and Boston join forces to launch a sonic attack on your ears, mind, and heart. Launching the primary mission at 2000 hours EST is the Canadian force of Chris Devonshire. The only winner in this war is you. Tickets are $9, $7 for students at the door. More official information can be obtained at 53 Music, an allied presentation of the Music Gallery and CKLN FM. Not available on CNN.
Bob. Oh, he's playing with the mic. I can't. Hey, Bob, can you talk into that thing just to see if it's working? Anything happening with it? No, nothing's happening. Well, let's just try this and see if that works. Nothing there? Nothing there. We're going to play around with you here. Man, what the hell is going on? I don't know. They disconnected me. Just a second here, people, so. There.
Freedom in a Vacuum at the Music Gallery marches into your life each Thursday in March, featuring some of the most vital and exciting experimental music from around the world. The series begins with the dreamlike sonic images of PGR. Hailing from San Francisco, PGR debuts its Ambient Chaos in Toronto on March 7th at the Music Gallery, 1087 Queen Street West. The concert begins at 8 o'clock p.m. with Kazunichi setting a mysterious mood for Twin Peaks sound editor PGR. Tickets are $9, $7 for students at the door. Call Laura at 53 Music for more clues. Brought to you by the Music Gallery, CKLN, and Ball.
Is that working over there? It's not working. It's, what the hell is going on? Try that. No. Nothing. Now, closing the door is not going to work. Well, this is real weird here. What the heck is going on? Technically inept tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, well, what the hell is this? Drag a chair in here, but I'm...
Yeah, just move over just a bit to get the...
Mike Hogg.
Okay.
Mike Hogg.
All right.
I should get the... Zappa in here.
Get ready. Okay, we just heard the exes talking to me about death for about an hour, over an hour, and I bet you it was interesting. And we got some interesting talk with Frank coming up. Frank talks about his plans to move us to Australia. And then there's some esoteric explanation of stuff about what does Grand Wazoo mean, Evelyn the Modified Dog. But just before we do that, we're going to interview Ken.
We don't know why. Damn things. Piece of crap.
Is it... Are we on?
Oh, yeah, we're on. I've been...
Okay, Ken. My first question is, for a guy who's had quite a underground experience and gritty life in London, 10 years ago?
15
years ago?
Yeah, about that.
No, you were 15 years old.
I was over there when I was 17.
Okay.
About 13 years ago.
So when were you born?
1959.
Okay, so 17 would be 76. So you were over there when the Sex Pistols just started to break.
Explosion.
Why were you there? You quit school?
Yes.
You dropped out?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
I got the Leary gig, you know?
What?
Got that Leary gig.
You believed
him? Turn on, drop out.
You've read something? Or?
Oh, yeah, well, I've read Leary, but...
He inspired you?
When I went back to school later.
Yeah, he didn't inspire you to drop out. You were just a normal alienated kid.
Yeah, I was basically, alienated, looking for things, looking for an identity, which was not found over there, that's for damn sure.
And ecstasy. Looking for ecstasy, too, right? Right?
Always.
Yeah.
Always looking for that. Well, isn't everybody?
Well, let me just say the question. So a guy who's lived in the, what's the word, in Bohemia?
The sleaze pit.
Yeah, slummed. You slummed it.
Okay.
Why?
Well, I'm not really slummed. I squatted.
Yeah.
That's what.
Yeah, you squatted.
Yeah.
That's a rugged life. So I wondered why whenever I spit up some mucus.
Clear your lungs?
Yeah, when I need to clear the mucus out of my throat before the show.
They go, nice throat?
Yeah, you don't like me making that sound, and I thought a guy who lived in... what's so repugnant about it?
Nothing. It doesn't bother me.
So you don't mean that?
I'm just irritating you.
Oh, okay. All right. So, in other words, it would be incomprehensible if you were irritated by it. I mean, it's a noisy thing, but...
It doesn't bother me.
I would think a person like yourself would not be bothered, considering you play a lot of noise on your show.
Yes, Beer cans. No, we've got like Violence from the Sacred coming up later, and Sleep Chamber, and Frank.
So I was hoping maybe you didn't like it, really. So then we could talk about it. You know what?
But there's a discussion about phlegm.
No, it's probably justified that one should be entertaining in the noise one makes. It shouldn't be disgusting.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite. It's quite a healthy sound to really do a healthy, throaty phlegm exhumation, right? You know, it sounds good if you do it right.
Yeah.
But I only do it once every 2 weeks.
Now, you do it about 5 or 6 times every 2 weeks.
Yeah, but I don't do it the rest of the time. Not too much, anyway. Yeah. So, okay, so that question's
out. Window in here. You know, you're
okay,
home.
Yeah, so, Kent,
yes,
it's your last night.
Yes, bro.
And did you learn anything doing this for 2 years?
I learn anything? In which...
any way you can respond to the word learn.
Technically, no. Aesthetically, yes.
Oh, what did you learn aesthetically?
We don't want to discuss that.
all right, then. Technically...
Technically, I knew everything that I had to do anyways.
Yeah.
I knew all of...
Okay, well, how about being...
To get into the actual operation of a radio station to perform a specific duty is something I already knew.
Well, what about the experience of being discarnate, like, and having to interact and receive request phone calls. Did that give you a sense of relating to people in a new way, or a different way, or did you learn
from different way?
Did you learn about people in a way? Of course, you would learn, I guess, something about people in this context.
You learn from each and every phone call.
And what are some of the things you could say you learned? You can be honest.
It's also something that you wouldn't really want to discuss because it's personal opinions.
Right.
And this is feeding back here.
This?
No. It was just because we have the door open.
So you can't talk about that.
Yeah, it's personal opinions of what.
Well, did your opinions of people change?
No. Not to any substantial degree. I always figured that people are generally intelligent. And they've proven that point to me.
Oh, okay.
Because they've always come up with intelligent questions about music or sounds or spoken word pieces.
So if you didn't really learn anything, what did you get out of this experience?
Self-satisfaction, more than anything.
Of what?
The satisfaction of actually doing a quote-unquote radio show. Does wonders for the ego. It's not necessarily why I'm here, or was here.
That's an automatic reflex.
Yes.
Yeah. So that you... the basic automatic reflex thrill is to have what you like imposed on people.
Not necessarily imposed, no. Because people always call up if they don't like what is being played or said. They are always entitled to call up and justify their reasons. Or not that they have to. Generally, most people that call up do justify their reasons for their dislike or liking of a particular piece.
But you get people to experience what you like. I mean, you assume people are taking in... Well, it's a thrill of playing something that you enjoy and putting it out there, and it's not that you're hoping they like it, but it's fun to find people who like it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that's where the ego comes in.
Mm-hmm. When they call up and say that this particular piece was just brilliant or something,
And they wouldn't have heard it otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's see. Where do you think you'll be in 5 years?
Do I have to answer this question here?
No, you don't have to answer
something
it.
That,
where do you think the world will be in 5 years?
The world will be in 5 years? Well, that's a nice choice one. Still engulfed in the Persian turmoil, perchance?
Yeah.
That's a distinct possibility.
Engulfed?
Yes. Double negative, double, shouldn't say double negative, because it doesn't necessarily cancel each other out.
Yeah.
It, basically no pun intended, or pun intended. That's up to your discretion.
So you studied with Burroughs,
mm-hmm.
William Burroughs, and then you read McLuhan's piece on Burroughs, and I would say my contribution to your knowledge is the McLuhan stuff. Probably weren't familiar with it until you met me.
Vaguely familiar with McLuhan. I was not a big student of McLuhan. I'd say nowhere near what I am now.
Yeah, you didn't know what nuggets of gold would be in there.
Yeah.
So I gave you McLuhan's review of Burroughs.
Yes.
Can you talk about that for a minute?
Not really, because I don't really remember everything that was in there. I'll have to go back over it.
Do you think McLuhan was you original in dealing with Burroughs?
Yes, I believe
he was. That was a new view of him that you've never read before.
It's true.
Yeah. So he's really original in that article. So
you have to remember, Bob, people ask me questions that dealing with 2 weeks ago, and I can barely remember 5 minutes ago.
Now, why is that?
I have a lot of things going through my mind at any particular point in time.
And why is that?
I'm a busy camper.
You don't have the Zen no mind going on?
No, there's no Zen no mind, Eric. It's
You,
I'm a busy camper. I have a lot of work that I do.
And are you thinking about your own jobs?
Not necessarily my own jobs. It could be, can be my paying job, and it can be my extracurricular activities.
You're processing information that you're taking in during the day that that's always going around your head.
Yeah.
So when you're when I've been here with you, you weren't thinking about what was immediately around.
No.
You're almost a distracted person.
An extent until spill that on the porch. It'll knock us off for weeks.
Yeah, well, we're not allowed to drink here.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, we're not allowed to drink around the porch.
Oh, do we have any more liquid slack?
Yeah, no.
No? What do you mean,
I'm not drinking this. This is empty. Anyways, so it just would have made noise. So, yeah, you were distracted? You were distracted?
Mm.
You are a distracted person?
No, not generally. It, as long as it has a certain amount of interest and has enough to keep me interested in it, I will sit and listen. And as soon as it becomes boring, I tend to get up and go somewhere.
Well, you have a lot going on in your mind. Do you find many people are like what you think you are in your mind? Are people you work with distracted like that? Get thinking about many things?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
You're not saying that you think more than other
people? No, definitely not. I'm hardly more intelligent than the next person, and I'm nowhere as stupid as the next person, shall I say.
Do you think people thought
or people are not as stupid as what they believe people to be?
Yeah.
They are not.
Do you think that the people were as distracted or had as many thoughts in their brain 200 years ago?
I would say yes. Maybe not as technical, but yes, they did.
So it's just the nature of consciousness.
Yes.
Mm. Well, let's go to Frank, and then we'll come back and talk to you some more, okay?
Yeah, okay, yeah, if you want. You can play around with the microphone some more.
Yeah, see if we can get it working.
We can do this.
Yeah. Our symphony. We used to do that.
Yes.
So this is Frank Zappa, recorded in December...
December 17th, 1990.
Interviewed by Trevor and Steve from Australia.
Whomever Trevor and Steve are or were.
Yeah, so why did you almost move to Australia?
Well, recently, as you might know, Dweezil was down there playing a series of concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't the only one who went down. My wife went, and she took two of the other kids, Amit and Deva. So the four of them were in Australia. Dweezil and Amit went first, and they were there for a few days, and they called up, and they said, "It's great here. We can breathe. The air is clean. The food is good. It's pretty," and they're really excited about it. So a few days later, Gail and Deva got on a plane and went down there and joined them. And they started looking around for to see what, you know, what it was like down there. And I'd been twice, so I already knew that you had clean air and, you know, the rest of that stuff. So that was their big surprise. So we were seriously discussing the possibility of moving my business down there. And I told Gail to look for some property. And I made an appointment at the Australian consulate in Los Angeles to go in and talk to them to see what kind of incentives the government might offer to move a business like I have to that country. So I went there with my lawyer and walked into this room full of people waiting to immigrate, and went to the little machine and took my number, which was 38. So I got it upstairs and waited for a little while, went and talked with a guy, and I told him two things. I said that I was interested in moving my record company and the rest of our businesses down there, and also approached him with the idea of doing this project that I'd had in mind for a number of years, which is based on the idea of the Bauhaus in Germany, which he wasn't familiar with, so I had to give him a quick history lesson to explain to him that between World War I and World War II, there was this thing called the Bauhaus, and people from all over the world came to Germany to work in this place, and it was an interdisciplinary
art factory, I guess you could describe it, where people working in all different fields would work together, and these interesting things were the product of that. And I was trying to find out whether the Australian government would like to encourage something like that in Australia, and if in fact it was feasible to do. Well, after I had explained to him all the things that I was interested in, he began with his lecture about Australian unions. And he basically made it very clear that nothing that I ever wanted to do in life could ever be done in Australia because of your union situation. So I thanked him and left.
That's a real shame, actually.
Well, it's a fact. I mean, he told me that if I were to put this institution in Australia, between the union regulations and the government regulations, I couldn't invite any craftsmen or artists from any place else in the world into Australia to work without getting union approval and government approval. They would have to do this nationwide search to find out whether or not there was somebody else who already lived in the country who couldn't do it as a job.
Yes, and if there was an equivalent,
You'd
have to take them, which is a little bit absurd, isn't it?
Yeah, but the idea of this is that you bring people from other parts of the world to interact with the people who are already in Australia so that you get some cross-pollinization of ideas and products, and the goal would be to have something that was located in Australia that would manufacture these new things there that would then be exported out.
I think you've actually just met Australia.
I just what?
You've met Australia.
I've met it. I was shocked. I had no idea when I went into that office what a horror story this man was going to tell me. And it's unfortunate. But
the union movement there is it's very reactionary.
That's a mild way of what he said. That's a very, very mild version of it.
It tends to keep the place very insular, unfortunately.
I'm sure there are some good aspects to it, and I'm sure that members of the union and their leadership would probably be willing to recite all the good points of their policy for hours and hours on end. But I see that there are so many bad points to it, things that tend to hold the country back. I mean, that little lecture from the guy at the consulate explain to me in a nutshell one of the reasons why a country with the resources that you have isn't more of a world player. It can't be. You're stuck.
It's historically entrenched that way as well, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, the numbers in the unions have been going down since the Labor government got in, because there's a lot of people who aren't happy with the agreement between the unions and the government.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been a slow trend away from that.
Well, based on what the guy at the consulate told me, the unions are stronger than the government still.
In a sense, yes.
I mean, the government is just kind of like a show that you watch, but the real power in the country is in the hands of the unions.
It's an unofficial
power. The union leadership.
Well, the problem with that is that the general population doesn't get... If the unions, in fact, control the country, that's not exactly democracy. If everybody in the country belonged to the union and you voted for the union leader, then it would, in fact, be a government. Yes. But if you have a minority that's actually controlling the government because of an economic stranglehold, that kind of disturbs the balance of a democracy, I would say.
It does. It messes it up. What it is almost is a de facto parliament, because... It's a two-party state, primarily, as it is here.
Yeah.
And so there's not terribly much to choose between the two parties.
Never has been.
That's exactly right. Yeah.